I appreciate my sister's word about being back. I think you know I haven't really left, but I'm just not here as much because I'm making a living more by being out in other communities of faith and whatever. And since I was with you last, earlier in September, I've been to a whole lot of different churches, and I got to tell you, and maybe I'm just a homer, but I have not sensed or experienced or felt the presence of God like I did this morning when we were worshiping in song anywhere else I've been. Maybe it's just because those aren't my home. I don't know, but I'm just going to tell you, it is good to be home and to be with you and to feel the presence of Christ with you. I did want to say, every once in a while I get collared for an announcement, and a lot of times I'll say no, but if I think it's a really good one, I'll say yes. But that kind of set me up there, didn't it? So if I say no to yours, it means I don't think it's a very good one. Sorry about that. But in any case, next week, men's retreat. And I got to tell you, James, where are you, James Friedland? Would you say this is the guy you want to see if you haven't registered yet? And listen, brothers, you want to go to this retreat. It's just the presence, to be present to one another, and we do a lot of that. And there is some speaking, yes. Several of the brothers are going to be sharing. I'm going to be sharing one talk myself. But just being together, where two or three are gathered together, and taking off the mask, and just being present, it is a healing time. And so if you want to go and you haven't signed up, sign up today. And secondly, if you say, man, I don't have the $100, nobody stays home because of no money. So I know it can be kind of hard to say that, but, you know, just whisper it to James, and it's done. It's taken care of. We want everyone there that God wants there. So even if you never thought about going to a retreat before now, sign up for this men's retreat, because I'm telling you, it's a life-changing weekend. Yeah, Brian. Yes, so if you miss today, hitch a ride, find a ride, drive yourself, and you can still sign up there. Good word. Also, since I don't get to talk to you much, let me just say this personal word. Some of you have asked me about my health because I was sick for about 5 weeks, and you know what the docs do when they don't know what you have. They start running through tests, and so they were testing for everything from infections to autoimmune diseases to cancer. Finally, they were looking for, you know, I got CAT scans for my whole body, basically. And what they think now is that I had a really bad case of mononucleosis, the kissing disease. Thank you, my brother. Since I only be kissing her, I don't know what that says, but... She didn't get it, so that shows how much we weren't kissing for 5 weeks, I got to tell you, you know, because I had all these fevers and sweats, and I'd go like this, she'd go, oh boy, no, I love you, but, and I don't blame her, really. And then, many of you have heard, you know, we've been on a long journey with Carla and her cancer, and so she had a PET scan the other day, which really looks for cancer in her whole body, and it came back clean. So we just, yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, she'll get another one in 6 months. It's typical protocol, but, you know, you just, and just to show you how mysterious our good Father is, we drove to a gas station right after we got done with her PET scan, and a sister drove up, and we just caught each other's eye, and I said, how you doing? She said, how are you doing? And I said, I'm all right. And then I said, wait a minute, I'm not just all right, man. I'm on cloud nine. My girl, my best friend, just got an all clear for the moment. And she said, you're blessed. And those are usually words that come from a sister in Christ. And so I was like, okay, I'm talking to a sister. And then she said, because we just lost my sister-in-law to a stage 4 cancer the week before. And I just was sitting there sharing my blessing, and she was sharing that God had chosen another path for her her sister-in-law, and I was just standing there in the mystery. And there was nothing really to say, so I just went over and we just embraced around that BP Amoco pump. And then she drove off to her journey. We pledged to pray for one another. And so would you pray for that family? They're getting ready to bury their loved one this week as we celebrate that God has left our Carla here for hopefully a good long time. Yes, dear. Oh, well, thank you for saying that. That's precious. And my heart is in your heart, and your heart is in mine. So thank you, sweetheart. So, sorry. Oh, Cindy's place, that's right. Well, she's going to have to move and sit here then if that's going to happen. So, thank you for allowing me that extra time this morning. I just wanted to share a few thoughts. So Acts 21 is where we are today. And as you turn there, and you're going to need to be somewhere close to the text today if you're going to follow this. I want to say that more than ever. But let me give you a word of background before we stand and read this together, because I really feel compelled to read this entire story today, even though it's a little lengthy. As you know, the book of Acts is all about how this new king, how his message gets spread. And in the specific context of what Joel taught last week, it's very clear that Paul has a very special love. He doesn't love more, but because he comes from this particular people group, he has a special love for his own people. He's doing everything he can in Jerusalem, trying not to hinder the spread of the good news of Jesus to his own people, to the point that he was willing to take a Nazirite vow, as I'm sure Joel preached to you, with four brothers to show that he wasn't dissing Judaism, so to speak. He was literally trying to just share the king that had come to fulfill all the promises of Judaism. But he got persecuted anyway. Earlier in Acts 21, it says the Jews from Asia, probably from Ephesus, accused him of bringing a Gentile, a non-Jew, into the inner court. The inner court was only Jews were allowed in the inner court. In the outer court, you could be a proselyte or a Gentile that was searching out God or believing in the Jewish God. In fact, in that inner court, there were literally signs that said, if you enter here and you're not Jewish, realize that we have the power to take your life. You will be under the penalty of execution. And so because Paul may have indeed, probably did, bring this Gentile because he was trying to bring, again, this fulfillment of Judaism, which is about all people, not just the Jews, that all Jerusalem was in an uproar, it says in verse 31. So the Romans intervened, and the commander, who was probably, you'll see a picture here, he was probably a Roman tribune. If you've watched any of the old movies like The Robe or Ben-Hur, this guy would have looked something like this. And what they did is the tribune came with some certain centurions, a couple of centurions at least, who were under him. And if there was more than one centurion, the centurions were over 100 soldiers each. So since he says centurions, there were probably at least 200 soldiers that came from the Antonia Fortress. And the Antonia Fortress is located, see the green? That was right adjacent, as you can see, to the Temple Mount and to the temple itself. And so they all flooded out, and they grabbed Paul because it was a mob. And so the Romans grabbed him, were taking him up into the Antonia Fortress with the crowd crying in, I guess we're talking verse 36, the crowd was crying out, away with him, away with him, which as some of you might remember is the same thing that the crowd said when they led Jesus away from Pilate 27 years before. So just to kind of set this up, if I was looking at some kind of a big idea, at least one of the big ideas of the first 21 chapters of Acts in terms of the spread of this message of this new king, it would be this. If we follow this King Jesus, we can expect to be persecuted like Jesus. Yes. And I think we kind of have to get over ourselves in America. We have to realize that we don't have some kind of special dispensation, that we get to share Christ and not be persecuted. If we're sharing the real Jesus, we will get the persecution that came to Paul, because Paul is us. Paul's not a special case. Paul is us. And what we're going to see today is that some persecutors, some of our persecutors, will believe in the same God, but they will believe in a very different Jesus. They might be very religious, but because they're not believing in the same Christ that we are trying to discover in the Scriptures, they will persecute us. So our task, as always, in the book of Acts and in our lives, is to discern who is the real Jesus, to strip him down from everything the enemy tries to put on him so that we can worship like or follow a pseudo-Jesus. The enemy doesn't care if we get like a half-Jesus. It's the whole real, raw, naked Jesus that has the power of the kingdom of God. And so our task is to discern who is the real Jesus. We only want to be suffering for him. So the story we're going to read this morning is a picture of how we, like Paul, can share, are called to share, must be ready to share anytime, even in a moment of persecution, this real Jesus, and he's going to show us by what he shares what we might want to share. It's almost like a template of evangelism. If we were going to say, how does it work to share Jesus? Paul is giving us that template this morning, and at the very end, we'll see how often the crowd, even the religious crowd, responds. So with that in mind, would you stand, please? And we're going to read through this story, and I'm going to read without much commentary, then we'll go back and just work through each section. As in most biblical sermons, there's three parts. If you have four, it's probably not from the Lord. Just teasing. All right, here we are. So they've just set away with him. And then as Paul was about to be led into the barracks of the Antonia fortress, he said to the commander, "May I speak to you?" And he replied, "Well, can you speak Greek?" And he said, "Are you not the Egyptian?" The centurion or the tribune said, "Are you not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a rebellion and led the 4,000 assassins out into the wilderness?" Paul said, No, that's not me. I'm a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city, and I implore you, permit me to speak to the people." So when he had given him permission, Paul stood on the stairs of the Antonia fortress and motioned with his hand to the people, and then there was a great silence. He spoke to them in the Hebrew language, would have been Aramaic, and he said, "Brothers and fathers, hear my defense before you now." And when they heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they kept all the more silent. And then he said, "I am indeed a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia and brought up in this city, Jerusalem, at the feet of Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God as you all are today. And I persecuted this way." They called themselves the way. The followers of Jesus of Nazareth called themselves the way. "I persecuted followers of this way to the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women, as also the high priest bears me witness, and all the council of the elders, from whom I also received letters of approval to the brothers, and went to Damascus to bring in chains, even those who were there to Jerusalem in order to be punished. Now it happened as I journeyed and came near Damascus, at about noon, suddenly a great light from heaven shone around me, and I fell to the ground, and I heard a voice saying to me, 'Saul, Saul,'" which was Paul's former name before his conversion to Christianity or to Christ, "'why are you persecuting me?' And so I answered, 'Who are you, Master? Who are you, Kyrios? Who are you, Lord?' And he said to me, 'I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. And those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they didn't really hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So I said, "What shall I do, Master?" And the Lord said to me, 'Arise and go into Damascus, and there you will be told all things which are appointed for you to do.' And since I couldn't see for the glory of that light, being led by the hand of those who were with me, I came into Damascus. And then a certain Ananias, a devout man according to the law, having a good testimony with all the Jews who dwelt there, came to me and stood and said to me, 'Brother Saul, receive your sight.' And at that same hour, I looked up at him. And then he said, 'The God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will and see the just one and hear the voice of his mouth, for you will be his witness to all men and all women of what you have seen and heard. And now, why are you waiting? Rise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord.' And it happened when I returned up to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple. I was kind of like in this trance. And I saw him again saying to me, make haste, get out of Jerusalem quickly. They're not going to receive me and they're not going to receive your testimony concerning me. So I said, Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprisoned and beat those who believe on you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I also was standing by consenting to his death and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him. And then he said to me, depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles. And they listened to him until this word. And then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, away with him again, for he is not fit to live. And they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust into the air. And the commander, the tribune, ordered him to be brought up into the barracks. It was over. And said that he should be examined under scourging, which is what Jesus endured, by the way. Those lashes could kill a man. So that he might know why they shouted so against him. They were kind of trying to extort the real truth from him. And so they bound him with thongs. Paul said to the centurion who stood by, wait a minute, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned without trial? And when the centurion heard that, he went and told the tribune, saying, take care of what you do, for this man is a Roman. It's a high offense to bring that kind of penalty upon a Roman who hasn't even stood trial. Then the commander, the tribune, came and said to Paul, tell me, are you a Roman? He said, yeah, I am. The commander had answered, with a large sum, I obtained this citizenship. Well, how'd you get yours? Paul said, I was born a citizen, homeboy. Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him. Whoa. And the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman because he had bound him. You may be seated. Man, what a story. Okay, this is how it breaks down, part one. First of all, Paul, in verses 37 through 39 and even into 40, which is a transition verse, Paul receives permission to speak to the people. So follow this. Paul says to the tribune in Greek, because it was the lingua franca of the world ever since Alexander the Great had conquered the world, but I don't think this tribune thought that Paul was that smart. He just didn't expect him to be that, I don't know. He just thought he was a rabble-rouser. So when he spoke Greek, the guy goes, man, you speak Greek? And then he said, you know what? I'll bet you're that Egyptian rebel. Now, what the text doesn't tell us is what Josephus tells us in some of his writings, that about 3 years before this date, a large rebel force was led to the Mount of Olives right outside of Jerusalem by this man who was an Egyptian. He called himself a prophet, probably claiming to be the Jewish Messiah. And what he told his followers out there on the Mount of Olives, he said, wait, and I'm going to command the Jerusalem walls to fall flat. Well, guess what didn't happen? The walls did not fall flat, and so the guard, probably the same guard that came out of the Antonia Fortress that came down upon Paul, went out to the Mount of Olives. They quelled the rebellion, but the Egyptian prophet, so-called prophet, slithered out. And so the centurion, I think, was standing there going, we found the guy. He's here. He's come back, and he's been living amongst us, and we found him. Paul says, no, that's not me. But let me tell you who I am. And he is here trying to say, I know what you think I am, but I'm not what you think I am. I'm a Jew from Tarsus. You can see Tarsus on the map. It's south central Turkey. You see the arrow in today's geography. Back then it was in Asia, in that very same spot. It was the capital of the ancient Roman province of Cilicia. It was a significant port city. It was a significant trade route city. By the way, piece of trivia, it was the first meeting place of Mark Antony and Cleopatra, the home of that budding of that great romance. They were known for their schools. Their schools rivaled both Athens and Alexandria. They had a library that at one time contained more than 200,000 volumes. So Paul says, I come from no mean city. You think I'm just some guy here making trouble and I'm just underneath your fingernails and you just need to kind of slap me away and get me out of the way so you can move on with your comfortable life. I got to tell you, I'm a significant Jewish citizen that comes from a significant city. So I'm asking you, will you let me speak to my people? So what we have here is Paul standing up for himself. Now, don't miss this. It might be easy to say that he is standing up for himself to save his skin. I don't think so. The word defense is used. He's there to give his defense. I think it's Luke's commentary on him trying to tell the Jewish people the real truth. They should not need to persecute him or kill him. He's trying to defend himself in the sense of, let me tell you the real story. You think you know the story. You don't know the real story. But he's really not trying to save his own skin. He sees an opportunity, even in this moment where his life is on the line, to share his relationship with Jesus. Now, one of the things we have really screwed up in modern American Christianity, and I know it is kind of hot in here, don't you think? It's kind of stifling. If I don't know if the air could go back on or we get some windows, but in any case, one of the things we've done with the word evangelization today is we've made it a separate entity, almost like what we've done with the word worship. We come to church to worship, whereas really we all know that the word means to serve yourself up. And really, a piece of our worship is here, but we really believe in whole life worship. We talk about it all the time here, whole life worship. The word evangelism, we've taken to mean it's a thing that we go out to do. We're living our life, and then one day we say, I'm going to take 2 hours to evangelize. My brothers and sisters, that is a perversion of the word. The word simply means to share the good news of Jesus. Paul, and you check this out in Acts, you check it out. Paul never went out to evangelize. I'm not mad at churches. I'm not mad at groups. I do a lot of work for certain groups that have made a living and won a lot of people to Christ by going out to evangelize. But here's what I think the enemy says. Well, he wouldn't say thank God. Thank me, he might say to himself, since he believes he's the Lord, or should be the Lord. I'm so thankful that those believers think that there's a certain day or time of the week that you go out and kind of do your witnessing, and then you go off and live. Paul didn't believe that. Paul shared Jesus every time life gave opportunity, because that's what his relationship with Jesus was about, and he knew that that's what the call was to those who know him, is to share him as a matter of course of life. And so Paul would go into a city and go to the synagogue, because that's where you could talk about religious matters. He did not, I don't know of a time that he just walked down into the middle of town and said, I'm going to start to share Jesus. Now, maybe Athens would be an illustration of that kind of sharing. But even then, he went to Mars Hill, the Areopagus, which is where the philosophers gathered to talk about religious things. And so he was always, he thought, I've got to share Jesus, because Jesus is the answer to the world's problems. He's the one who has come to save us and deliver us. So I've got to share him wherever I can. I'm looking for opportunities. I'm not going to go out and take 2 hours of the day like I've got some kind of a vacuum cleaner to sell. He is my life. And so I'm just looking for opportunities to share. And so even persecution for Paul, all he was thinking about was, you know, I don't want to die. I don't want to be scourged. But can I just say, this might be a chance for me to share my lover with a world that longs to know that they're loved. And so you might say it something like this. Sharing Jesus isn't a planned event, but it's us telling our story of Jesus, our story of Jesus, when life opens a door. The more we fall in love with Jesus, the more doors will become apparent to us. You go through a whole day and say, didn't see no doors. When I fell in love with Carla, man, we could have been talking. I could have been talking to somebody about the latest college football championship game, and I'd find a way to bring it back to you. Did you hear? I've fallen in love. I just want to tell you about my girl who's quickly becoming my best friend. If we think the world's going to come to Christ because we create evangelism strategies that we do 4 times a year, we are satanically deluded. What was intended, this is the piece of the story of the book of Acts, is that the message of the king would be shared by an army of lovers who have fallen in love, who know that without him they're dead. And they're so filled with love that they see every moment that has people involved as a potential opportunity. And yes, sometimes it just isn't appropriate. But the more we fall in love, the more those doors will seem to be appearing at every turn. Evangelism isn't a planned event. It's us telling our story of Jesus when life opens a door. So, this is the second piece. Paul tells his story, and he's going to tell his story in two, you could say three stages. If you want to see another place that Paul tells his story, it's a few chapters over when he talks to Herod Agrippa, where he shares it in even more detail. But the first piece of Paul telling his story, you might say it simply like this. He tells the crowd, this is who I was before I met Jesus of Nazareth. The first piece of telling our story, when a door opens so we can tell our story, is this is who I used to be before I met Jesus. This is who I was. This is the prequel, if you will, of my life. Before I met my love, my healer, my new king. A couple different ways he does this. First of all, notice that what he shares connects his life with the life of the people. Sometimes we are so religious. When we start sharing, do we forget how it felt to have some religious person share Jesus with us before we knew Jesus? With all that lingo, with all those fancy words, with all that language that makes the non-believing person feel other than us, Paul does exactly the opposite of that. The first thing he does is he moves from Greek to Aramaic. And I got to tell you, the crowd who thought they had pegged him, he's a betrayer, he's not a good Jew, he's betraying our very life, our very principles, our history. He opens his mouth and out comes the lingua franca of the people. He speaks Aramaic, and you notice twice it says they immediately went, whoa. They were like, you know. He speaks Aramaic. They go, wait, this guy. Have you ever noticed when you're sharing Christ with a non-believing person and they're like, they can feel it sometimes. And here it comes. You feel an open door. You're starting to share and they're like, Here it comes. Here, I'm getting ready. And they batten down the hatches. They tie themselves to the mast because here it comes. Here comes the spiel. And here comes the four spiritual laws. And here comes, and the four spiritual laws are great, but you get what I'm saying. And all of a sudden, the person that's sharing just shares like a stinking human being. They're just talking like the folks. I'm not saying you got to be all rude in your language or all crude, or you have to be swearing and all that stuff. I know. I knew somebody was going to come up with that. She said, sorry, crude and swearing works. I'm just going to tell you, you follow the Holy Spirit. But the Holy Spirit's never going to lead you toward talking religious lingo with folk who are just waiting for you to talk religious lingo so they can turn you off. And so, you know, I could tell you this brief story. This is where my sermons get long. I always go down these little bunny trails, sorry. But I was telling Josh today, I'm an old dog, and new tricks just ain't seeming to happen to me too often. I was in seminary, and we had signed a commitment. We will not, have any alcohol. And, well, we're in seminary. I wasn't a big drinker anyway. I wasn't really about signing that little thing telling me what I could or couldn't do. I mean, expect me to be a grown man. At that point, I'm like 27, and you're telling me, you know, no, 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 no. And so I didn't like that, but I thought, okay, for the sake of the cause. So I'm with one of my non-believing buddies, and we're getting really close, and we're at a ball game. He goes off to get us some hot dogs, and he comes back. He brought me, to this day in my life, I was about 27 at that time, he brought me the biggest beer that I have ever seen in my life. And you know, if you're at a ball game, it's not even good beer. But, you know, I thought, I signed a contract. I'm probably going to get let go from seminary. And my brother, who doesn't know anything about Christianity, and the first thing that I don't want him to know is that, well, you got to know if you're going to believe in Jesus. What you can't ever do is drink a bad beer. Now, that beer was so bad, can I tell you, I did not drink much. But it wasn't because I was trying to save my seminary career. I was trying to speak in the language of the people. And Paul goes on here. He mentions Gamaliel, who was a teacher of the strict law. Gamaliel's mentioned earlier, by the way, in the book of Acts. He was a well-known teacher in that day. And basically what he's saying is, in fact, he says it here in verse 3, you can see, Gamaliel was zealous toward God. Look at this phrase, as you all are today. I got taught by Gamaliel. You all think I'm way over here, but I got taught by Gamaliel, who is as you are today, more than you know. I am, Paul says, as you are today. If we don't connect with the people, my brother, it'll take a bigger miracle than the gospel itself to get them to hear anything we have to say. If the very thing we start out with separates us from them, why are they going to listen to our words about our loving Jesus? And then the second thing he does is he shares the raw, sordid truth about his life before Jesus. You put that next one up there, my brother. He shares the raw, sordid truth about his life, but there it is. He says, I used to persecute these brothers and sisters to the death. I was a murderer. That's who I was before I came to Christ. I'm not that anymore. Listen to me. Sometimes it is very difficult to retell our pain before Christ, but it is endemic to our non-believing friends knowing how powerful Jesus can be to them by us telling them how powerful Jesus has been to us. To do that, we've got to do the hard work sometimes of bringing up appropriately our past story, as sordid and dark as it may have been. Are you tracking with this? I know some of you are saying, well, I trusted Christ at the age of 6. So my story would go something like this, you might say. Yeah, before I met Jesus, I was involved in some hardcore playground thuggery. I'd go out there on recess. I had my crew over here. We would just be looking for victims. I've heard folks that say, I don't share Christ, say, well, I don't have some big Damascus Road thing, and my life before Christ was, all right, how about this? I got saved when I was 5, and then I lived somewhat miserably till I was 36, till quite frankly, I mean, I might have believed in Jesus. I think I did believe, but I didn't know the real Jesus. So the story I tell today is more about what was going on in my life before 1990, when I almost took my life, because Jesus was something that wasn't life-giving to me. He wasn't light. He wasn't life. What if you know, and if you don't know this, let's talk. If you know that today, whatever it was like in your pre-8-year-old years, if you don't know today that without Jesus you are dead, then why are you here? I'm not, look, please don't think me being harsh, but do we see what's going on in culture? We don't have time to just say, we go to church because we go to church. I'm hoping you're here today because you know that without Jesus Christ, you are dead. You're either dead or a dead woman, dead man walking. So tell that story. Let that be your pre-conversion story. In fact, you can say, I trusted Christ when I was 8, but I didn't know anything about him. And I lived under law. I just tried to do all the right thing. And then one day, I realized I couldn't do it anymore. And then I cheated in my marriage, or I found myself with an addiction, or I realized I didn't want to live anymore, or I realized there was no passion in my life. And I got on my knees and I said, are you real? And he came to me, and my life has never been the same. Paul connected with the people and he told them the real story of the way it was before Jesus. Are you with me? And then the last thing he did is he says, this is how I met Jesus and this is how he's transformed my life. So notice that his focus is on Jesus of Nazareth. If you look at verse 8, so I answered, who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. This was no ghost. This was no docetic Jesus. Docetism, which was that early church movement that said he wasn't really a man. He's kind of more of a will-o'-the-wisp kind of, you know, apparition. I think Paul clearly says, he says, I saw a light, and the light was blinding. Can you see, by the way, why Paul, when he writes in his letters about Jesus being the God-man, here's the origin, what he saw. He's going, how do I explain it? The light, 3 times in this text, the light blinded me, the light knocked me on my can, the light. But then he said, but this was Jesus born as a man in Nazareth. You want to know where his theology of Jesus was the God-man? I mean, don't watch the Tom Hanks movie and buy all that nonsensical pseudo-history about how at the Council of Nicaea, people just kind of made this up. This is where the God-man was revealed to the main guy who shared Christ with the world. When he began to describe who he was that he had met that had changed his life, the only thing he could say was, he was really a man, but I gotta tell you, he was so much more. I never met a man that had that much light in him. When that light hit me, knocked me on my arrogant can. In fact, you can just hear him in 2 Corinthians 4 when he says, for it is the God who commanded light to shine out of darkness, who is shown in our hearts. He's saying, who first shone in my heart? I saw the light, man. To give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus. He's saying, I didn't just see the light. I saw it in the face of Jesus of Nazareth. So here's the point. When we share, first, here's who I was. Language of the people, all the dark details that we think at the moment with that person need to be shared for them to know, this is no religious trip I'm on. This is life. The next thing we share is Jesus of Nazareth. Hear this clearly. You're not arguing theology with a person, which doesn't mean that there might not be a few moments where you're answering apologetic questions to the best of your ability. But we're not here to argue theology. We're not here. You are not there to save anyone. Take the load off your life. Many of us don't want to share because we're afraid we can't land the deal. It's not yours to land. It's not mine to land. We're not there to get in theological arguments. We're not there to convert someone. Dig this. We are not there to change somebody's lifestyle. Take this in. If the first thing you see in a non-believer's life is, well, they're doing all that stuff, then I don't mean to be, You need to get back with Jesus and let him break your heart for that human being that's underneath all that mess. If all you can see is, well, I got to get him out of his stuff. Half the time we can't get ourselves out of our own stuff. We're not there to change someone's lifestyle. Nobody could have changed Paul's lifestyle. He needed to see the light of Christ. So what we're there to do is to share how Jesus has changed our life. Now, before we begin to land this plane, let me just say this. Some of us struggle with evangelism because we don't have much of a story about how Jesus has changed our life. We know John 3:16. We believe that it's not Buddha, it's not Muhammad, it's not any of the million gods in the Hindu pantheon. We believe we're going to heaven because Jesus died on the cross. Paul didn't even share that. He didn't share his atonement theology. Are you tracking here? He shared, this is who I was, and Jesus, then I met Jesus. Maybe our struggle, I hear people all the time beating folk up because they don't share Christ. I'm not here to beat you. I don't want you beating me up. I'm not going to beat you up. I am saying, if you struggle to share, if you never see an open door, if you just, it's just not a piece and you've argued, well, I'm not an evangelist or I'm not whatever, could it be time to take an inside look and just to say, maybe I need to get on my knees and ask Jesus, just ask him to show you what your life would be without him. Can I promise you, he will lovingly, but buckle thy seatbelt. He will lovingly, but so strongly answer that prayer. Because remember, he knows he's the king. And his chosen method of showing the broken world that he is the king is you and me. So if you say, show me what I don't have if I don't have you, he will answer that prayer so that you can come up into the front of his army and start seeing open doors everywhere to share the good news of what he's done in your life. Not, I want you to come to my church. Invite them for sure. Especially if they're tithers. Invite them. Cut that from the tape. I would never say that. Pete might, but I won't. And then he shares his transformation. And you look at verse 14, 15 in Acts 22. He went from killing the people who were of the way to being his witness to all people of what he had seen and heard. When you share with folk, you don't just share Jesus, you share how he changed your life. You're not there to share how you're perfect or how religious you are or what you do in the church. Here's what you're there to say. John 9. And the Pharisees go, I want to know what you think about this man, Jesus of Nazareth, theologically. I don't know. One thing I know, I was blind. Now I see. That's what we're there to share. When I share Jesus, if God allows the door to be so open, so wide, I get to this point, I'm like, can I just tell you, man? I was a pastor of a church. I knew the Bible inside and out, and I wanted to die because I didn't know who he really, I didn't know how he felt about me. I didn't know that he really loved me. But today, I don't want to die. I want to live. And I know that I'm loved, and all I want to do is love folk. Doesn't that sound like a plan? I might say to the non-believer. I've never had a non-believer who ever, when I said, doesn't it sound like a plan to gather around somebody and go love the world? And I've never had a non-believer say, no, way too religious for me. When they hear about, they know, they intuitively know that love changes folk. What they're waiting to see is a bunch of folk that love has changed. So that when we share with them, we're not giving them the party line. We're telling them about how that love has changed our life. Can you imagine the woman in Luke 7, after she got done kneeling at the feet of Jesus and weeping her tears? The text seems to indicate she was a woman of the night, if you will, in that day. But certainly never met him, but heard him. She hadn't even met him. There's no indication in the text she'd met him. She heard him, and just hearing him, something came out of him, man, that she said, that man, that's not like any other man I've ever heard. Men have hurt me. That man, I can tell he loves me. When she heard he was in her town, she ran past Simon the Pharisee. I can just see him standing there like this. I got the new rabbi here, man. I'm hot. I can see her going by and say, excuse me, Lord, boom, as she ran. She didn't do that. As she ran toward the feet of Jesus and fell down, and he said, your faith has made you well. Can you imagine her go out and share in Jesus? Well, you know, I was in the synagogue the other day, and they had a reading, and I noticed that would be all right, I guess. There's nothing wrong with having a Bible text that helps us find Christ. Are you kidding me? That's what the Bible's written for. But I got to tell you, that lady went out and said, this is what my life was like. And then I met a man who loved me so well that all I could do was fall at his feet and wash his feet with my hair. Can you imagine her telling that story to people that knew what she used to be, and then her to say, and that other thing I used to do, it's all forgiven. And yeah, but did you have to do anything? No, it's just forgiven. He told me I was forgiven. He said, it's gone. It's gone. Go in peace. Your faith has made you well. Can you imagine that other tormented person living in that first century community who's just tormented by the Greco-Roman gods, if they were religious at all, who were so capricious? You know, you studied it in 7th and 8th grade, you know, theology or Greco-Roman theology in your Latin classes, in your history classes. They were so capricious, and they're going, there's a God who just receives us and forgives us and heals us. That's your story? I want to know him too. Last thing, reaction and response. Now look, many times in Acts, somebody will share, and it says, many believed. Many believed. And the church grew. Remember earlier in Acts, it was 5,000, then it was, I don't know, 10,000 or whatever. Not so here. Now, I'm not saying that nobody believed in this crowd. I believe whenever somebody shares like that, there's somebody out there that goes, my Lord, this is what I've been looking for all my life. But notice, the crowd listened intently until Paul mentioned the Gentiles. They must have not listened as intently back up in verse 15 when he said what? I've been sent to how many men? All. Folk can hear us talking about reaching all. How are they going to argue with that? If they know anything about Jesus, he died for all. What gets them upset, I've noticed, especially in the religious crowd, is when you start getting specific about a certain group of human beings that you feel especially maybe have not been reached well, or maybe have, they're just on your heart. You just want to make sure they know too. Not they, meaning categorizing a group. You get what I'm saying. That the Jews did not get upset until Paul mention the Gentiles, and then they threw dust in the air and they tore their clothes. It was a typical Jewish lament when they thought someone had blasphemed. Judaism had sunk so low that to mention specifically who the all people meant riled up the crowd to the point that they didn't even remember that this is why Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldees to begin with, so that out of his loins could come a blessing to what? All nations. And then one more time, verse 22, they said, away with him. Here's what you can take from this, I think. When we share our experience with the open-armed Jesus, we can expect some persecution to come from religious people who are uncomfortable with us passionately. They will let you passively welcome a group if you get passionate. They will be religious people that don't understand this raw, naked Jesus who has reached them with his love will start to get up in your grill. They will be uncomfortable with us passionately welcoming all in his name. He equally wants, our king, our lover wants to reach white folks and black folks and Latino folks and rich folks and poor folks and Asian folks and gay folks and straight folks and hardcore Republicans and hardcore Democrats. He wants to reach Muslims. He wants to reach radical Islamists. The more we get to know the Jesus who has so graciously welcomed us with free forgiveness into his family, the more we will get passionate about everyone. And the more we will tend to see individuals and groups that seem to still be marginalized. And if we get passionate about those individuals or those groups, look out, because some of our persecution will not come from the Romans. It will come from those who worship the same God but don't believe in the same Jesus. So, oh, and by the way, I got to say this. If you have any of you have texts where you still have red letters in it? Any of you still have a Bible like that? If you look at the book of Acts, it's just got me. In the book of Acts, there's more red lettering. What does the red letter mean? Jesus is speaking. In the book of Acts, the most red letters, meaning Jesus is talking, Acts 9, where Luke narrates Paul's story, Acts 21 and 22, where Paul narrates his story, Acts 26, where Paul narrates his story again. With all the mess that that entails, all the persecution, you know what I took this to mean? In the midst of us sharing our story in some of the most uncomfortable, but we know it's an open door circumstance, with people shouting, and literally just because we want to reach everyone and because he's our lover, in those moments, frightening sometimes, Jesus is speaking all around those moments. And he's saying, don't you ever, I'm the one that knocked you off your high horse and brought you back to myself with my healing arms. I'm the one that's blinded you with the light. I'm the one that sent you to Ananias. I'm the one that allowed you to see my face so that you could reach all people. And I'm the one that will be with you all the way to Rome as you share my good news. Don't you love that? To end, this is the big idea. If you wanted to have a big idea, if you wanted to capture this text, this is the way I think you could capture it. The good news of Jesus is spread by us. The Calvary's not coming. We're it. Often spontaneously in the middle of our real lives, wherever you're planted, those are your folk. Those are your folk, man, at the 7-Eleven. In the last year, with all of my baggage, y'all, and if you know me well, you know I got baggage. I've shared my Jesus in various ways with my doctor, my neighbor next door, my Islamic sister at the coffee shop, with the Uber driver about a year ago. I ain't no evangelist. I don't go evangelizing. I never set out a part of my day or my week or my month to evangelize. I don't Google evangelism ever. But without Jesus, I'm dead. With him, I'm alive and I'm in love. And I know he's the answer. This is what Luke's trying to say to us. It's us sharing Jesus in the middle of our real lives, sometimes in the face of persecution, how the real Jesus has changed our lives. I think they're saying, it's over, Kev. Would you bow with me, please? And I'm sure we're going to sing a song to get out of here. My Father, I pray that none of my brothers and sisters today are discouraged. I do pray that many of us are challenged to take an inside look, not about how many salvations have we had in the last 2 years, my Lord. What kind of a question is that? But how we can know you, Jesus, in a way that lets us know that you're everything to us. Even in the midst of our unanswered questions, even in the midst of our pain, even in the midst of persecution, that we would know what Paul knew that nobody could ever take away from him. No argument, no situation in life. He knew, Jesus, that you were his everything. Would you help us, Lord, at Hope, even as we get ready? Maybe we're on the cusp of a new senior shepherd, Lord, a new lead shepherd. Oh, God, don't let us wait to see how this new, don't let us put the pressure on this new person who's going to come in and somehow have some new little programs and some new little things. Oh, Lord, let him come in and see a community that, yeah, we're broken. Yeah, we have wounds. Yeah, we're still recovering from stuff. And every day it feels like there's more that life brings us. But let him come in and let him feel, or let her feel, this is a community in love with Jesus of Nazareth. That we know that without him we are dead, and with him we are alive and loved, and we love equally the whole world and are ready to share him at the drop of a hat. Would you let us be that, Lord? Would you, with your Holy Spirit, let us be that in Jesus' name? Amen.